Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place, and do anything that you want to do. But honey, lay off of my shoes, and don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
Blue Suede Shoes from Carl Perkins. It was Sun Records' first million seller. It was also to become a huge hit for Elvis Presley. Carl Perkins and Elvis Presley are just two of the many performers featured in the book DVD set The Rockabilly Legends, subtitled They Called It Rockabilly Long Before They Called It Rock and Roll. Good afternoon. This is The Afternoon Magazine. I'm your host for this hour, Jason Croft. And this afternoon, we'll be talking about rockabilly with Jerry Naylor and Steve Halliday, authors of The Rockabilly Legend. The book tells the story of rockabilly and the legends that came from it. And it's a personal remembrance of a particular time and place in American musical history. The book focuses on six main artists: Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Buddy Holly, Carl Perkins, Roy Orbison, and Jerry Lee Lewis. A little bit more about our guests. Jerry Naylor has been in the entertainment business for over 50 years and is a member of the West Texas Hall of Fame and the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. He watched the birth of rockabilly firsthand, and he became the lead singer of the Crickets after the death of Buddy Holly. Steve Halliday is a best-selling author and the president of Crown Media Limited. The Rockabilly Legends is published by the Jerry Naylor Company and Hal Leonard. As always, we invite your questions and comments locally. Call 333-9455 outside Champaign-Urbana. Call 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, or 800-222-WILL. Jerry Naylor, Steve Halliday, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I do have to apologize. I'm battling a cold, so I'm a little stuffed up today. But I really wanted to talk with you guys about this book and about the history of rockabilly. And a way to get started, why don't we just talk a little bit about the roots of rockabilly and where this music came from?
Well, Jason, it's Jerry Naylor here. Let me give that over to my great friend and co-author, to Steve. Steve is a master at this. So, Steve, you do the foundation. I'll pick up from there.
Well, Jerry is perhaps more kind than he is accurate, but I appreciate it anyway. I had a lot of fun writing this book with Jerry. Jerry has been around most of these guys that he talks about. Most of them were personal friends of his from the very beginning. He's just a few years younger than most of these guys. And as the book progresses, he talks about how he heard for the first time Elvis's record that really broke it open for everybody, That's All Right Mama, that he played as he was a DJ on the air at about, what were you, about 15 or 16, Jerry?
I was 15. I was 16, just turned 16.
Why don't you tell that story? Because I think it's a great place to begin.
Well, I started in radio in West Texas at age 14, and it was one of the first radio stations. It's now the sister station, is now become a historic landmark in the world of rock and roll, because it's KDAV in Lubbock, where Buddy Holly got his start. And I was at the sister station KPEP in San Angelo, Texas, and there's a whole story, which we'll get to after a while, about the three magic nights in West Texas where Elvis came for the first time, January 5th, 6th, and 7th of 1955, and it was from that indeed rockabilly flushed out of its corner of Memphis and the Louisiana Hayride and became a national movement, an international movement, indeed. But you ask about the influence. We all started in church. Actually, we started in small Pentecostal or Southern Baptist churches. For the most part, of every one of those, Jason, that you just mentioned, and a few others that we'll talk about, Gene Vinson, for instance, and Buddy Knox, and others, the Burnett brothers, who actually named, Dorsey and Johnny Burnett, who actually named the name rockabilly, part of 50s rock and roll. But we all came, our mothers played piano in these small rural churches. We all came from rural farming, cotton or sharecropping. And it was there that probably minutes after I was born, my mother wrapped me in an appropriate blanket and walked up the lane to the little Baptist church and set me at her feet as she played those great old shape notes. So it was influenced early by Southern gospel. Before that, the African-American spirituals. And we have a wonderful thing in our live performance where Steve says, do you realize that rock and roll began in the 17th century in Africa with African Americans and their spirituals, and then was brought forward, of course, with the African American spirituals and slave songs. From that came, of course, Black Delta blues, and then bluegrass music with Bill Monroe, hillbilly music, the traditional hillbilly music. It was called negativism in that name of hillbilly music, the greats of Hank Williams Sr. and Roy Acuff and the Carter family and all those great people that were on the Grand Ole Opry. That was part of the birth. And you add in a little bit of all of that together, and you've got what we know as rockabilly 50s rock and roll, which is the foundation of all rock and roll that came after it.
Go ahead.
One of the fun quotes for me was at the very beginning. We placed it at the beginning for this reason. It was a quote from Tillman Franks, who was personal manager and promoter and songwriter and really involved with all the beginning. He says, rockabilly is taken from some of those old gospel songs, black spirituals, the Delta blues, bluegrass, country and hillbilly. You know, it's the whole thing. Rockabilly covers it all.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems amazing how it's an amalgam of all these different styles, yet it became so unique in and of itself, this whole other entity that came out of it. Why do you think that this time period, the mid-1950s, was so ripe for this musical change?
Well, there was a lot going on. As you realize, the war was just over. There was, we talk about in the early stages of both the documentary, the three-hour feature documentary, and the book, about the fact that there was change around the world, and certainly in the United States. You had Dwight Eisenhower as a president, and we had a special conversion of change that was all over, certainly in the United States. And within that change was also, I believe, the perfect storm, if you will. It was the perfect coming together of a timing where people were ready to listen. They loved the big band, they loved jazz, they had all these things that came before. And and frankly, to have said all that, it was a pure accident. It was the result of the great movement, if you will, is the result of just a series of magnificent accidents. And again, with the perfect timing, people were looking for something new. There was the influx very shortly of the television for the first time. Television had a great deal to do with it. And I think that would be also radio stations were changing from the block format, Jason, you know, where you played a program of big band and then you'd play something local and news and drama and so forth. They were changing from that to a single format of all music, and certainly in some cases all specific genres of music. The two stations I mentioned earlier were the two first, KDAV and KPEP in Texas, were the two first full-time country music radio stations in America.
So I think Jerry, I wish you'd tell that story of when you heard That's All Right, Mama for the first time, because I think that really gets partly to the answer of what Jason is asking in terms of why did it kick off, because as you tell the story, it's like when, as soon as you heard that, you said, that's what I've been waiting for. That's what you didn't know for sure. You're waiting for something, but when you heard that, it triggered it. Why don't you tell that story?
Well, it was that. Each of us, and when I say each of us, I'll use three experiences. Buddy Holly in West Texas, Roy Orbison, who was my neighbor and friend and also in West Texas, 100 miles away from where I live, from San Angelo, and for myself, we all had little country bands, hillbilly bands, as you were. And we played gospel music, and we played the Southern gospel music, and then we played these hillbilly songs. And we were yearning for something else, because if we, you know, also radio was segregated, very, very much segregated, and we were looked down on if we would even think about, and also the churches were segregated. We would be severely reprimanded or looked down on if we were to break those boundaries, and somehow, and if you'd talk to each of us individually, you'd know without the other knowing, we would all say basically the same thing. There was a couple of radio stations, that big 50,000 watt radio stations, in the country that after midnight would play, and some down in Mexico that would play some of the blues, you know, the Delta blues songs. We would literally, as kids, you know, cover up and have battery radio. If you were lucky, maybe you had electricity, and sometimes we didn't. But either with the battery radio or small electric radio, we'd cover up, and after our parents were asleep, we would sneak listening to those great blues things. So we were hungry for something, mixing what we were already doing with some of the things that we knew were out there. 1954, August of 1954, there was a record that came from Memphis, Tennessee on Sun Records, a brand new label, bright yellow with a red with a black rooster on it. And there was I put it on the turntable. Now I'm 15 years old. I put it on the turntable, and all of a sudden I heard this big booming rhythm guitar, Martin guitar, and I heard an old what had been a blues song that I had heard before from Arthur Crudup with this new guy singing it. And it was Elvis Presley. It was That's All Right, Mama. And as Steve just said, I turned it up just as loud as I could and started bouncing around the studio literally saying, this is it. This is what I've been waiting for. And that would be the echo of the screams of everybody that heard Elvis Presley from that point on. His influence was absolutely unbelievable. Jump forward, if you will, till the January 5th, 6th, and 7th, real quick, and I'll do that. I hate to talk so long, but if you will, let me do this. On January 5th, 6th, and 7th of 1955, Elvis then came to, it was his first time into Texas, to San Angelo, Lubbock, and to Midland, Texas. Promoted by Tilman Franks, a name we mentioned a little earlier, Elvis had been brought to, he had gone to the Grand Ole Opry for one performance, did not do well, and we can talk about that later. But he then came to the Louisiana Hayride and just, as they say, knocked their socks off. I mean, it was just amazing. And so Tilman Franks, who was the talent coordinator for the Louisiana Hayride, called my foster father, actually, who owned the radio stations, and Joe Treadway, and said, I've got this brand new guy from Memphis, and let's book him. Well, they put him in the bottom of what would have been a Grand Ole Opry show. Billy Walker was a star of the Grand Ole Opry, and they put him at the top of the bill and put this Elvis Presley, a brand new guy. And actually, they didn't even know how to spell his name. And with a southern accent, Tilman Frank said to my foster father, Joe, he said, it's Elvis Presley. So Joe Treadway made up the sign saying A-L-V-I-S, Elvis Presley. And anyway, January 5th, he's there. The show opens. I actually opened the show with my little band and then stood backstage and watched Scotty Moore, Bill Black, and Elvis Presley take the stage. They had no drum. And they did their five songs that they knew. And I'm telling you, I saw the world change. It was a magic sound, and the people who were a bit in shock, they didn't know really who this was. They'd heard us play the That's All Right, Mama on the radio, and they liked it, and Blue Moon of Kentucky, which is the B-side of the record, and a couple of others that had come out by that time, follow-ups. But they didn't know what to think about this young man. Many people thought he was black, which is very interesting. And he walked out on stage, and he had developed, out of fear, this little shake of his legs. And it just was a magic time, pure magic time. He went to Lubbock the next night. Buddy Holly was standing backstage. Same thing happened. Buddy saw this. He said, that's what I'm going to do. The next night was in Midland, Texas. Again, Roy Orbison, who had a band called the Wink Westerners, was doing the same hillbilly and country music that we were all doing. And he was the opening act there. And again, Roy Orbison said, that's it. I'm gonna record like that Elvis guy. And it was the beginning of a major movement, which moved all over the world. It had happened already in Memphis with Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins, but now it had moved through West Texas through live performances. And my goodness, the results of that is still felt today.
Well, this is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with Jerry Naylor, who you just heard, and Steve Halliday. They are the authors of The Rockabilly Legends, a book and DVD set, and we're talking about the history of rockabilly today. And it was really interesting to kind of think about that first single from Elvis Presley, That's All Right, Mama, on the A side, and Blue Moon of Kentucky on the B side, because as you talk about, explain how that was kind of a 1-2 punch of covering both sides and influences of this music. Do you, understand what I'm saying?
I do indeed, yes. That's All Right Mama, as I mentioned, was Arthur Crudup's a black blues song, and it had been recorded in the late 40s. And right there in Memphis, early, actually, I guess the 49 or early 1950, right there at 706 Union Avenue with Sam Phillips. And so what happened is that sort of Sam Phillips, who owned the Sun Recording, it was called the studio then, was the Memphis Recording Services, and he was sort of tricked into Elvis. Sam had a dream. He said, if I can, he was recording all these wonderful black artists, B.B. King and Arthur Crudup and so many others, but they weren't selling very well. And being an entrepreneur and, of course, a radio promoter as he was and now in the recording business, Sam Phillips said, and no racial intended here, but if he could find a white young man who could sing like the black performers because he could get more airplay and it would sell more recordings, he could be very successful. And so he was looking for this person. Scotty Moore was a country guitar player, and he wanted to get a job working with Sam Phillips at his studio. And so he sort of made up a story. He interviewed and auditioned this Elvis Presley. Now, Elvis had gone into the Sun studio several months before, or the Memphis Recording Studio it was called then, a few months before, very shyly, to record some demos for his mother. But he wanted to be a ballad singer. He went in and sang like Perry Como, "I Saw the Harbor Lights," you know, and "Blue Moon." He wanted to be a ballad singer. And so they didn't shake any walls when he was there. But Scotty Moore heard about him from around town. He was entering various, you know, talent contests and things and losing every one of them, Elvis was. So, he finds Elvis on the hot July time in 1954 in Memphis, and he auditioned him. And Bill Black was a bass player that worked with Scotty Moore. Bill walked away saying, "Well, I didn't see anything positive there. That was not very good." And he used a couple of expletives when he said it. But so Scotty Moore called Sam Phillips and said, "Oh, this guy's really good. He can do exactly what you want. He knows those blues songs, you know, and he can play guitar a little bit." And so Sam said, "Bring him in tomorrow. This is the 4th of July. Bring him in tomorrow, the 5th." And they walked into the studio that night. And Elvis started singing these ballads and things, and this went on for a couple of hours, and it was going nowhere. And Sam had he liked a little taste of liquor, and he'd been drinking along, trying to ease the pain of a disappointment because he thought he had found the right person. He had the right looks, but he didn't have the right sound. And so finally he said, "One more thing, and we're out of here. This is done." And so Scotty Moore and Bill Black had gone to the restroom. While they were gone, Sam kept sort of yelling his disappointments. Elvis Presley was scared to death, and he picked up his rhythm guitar and just started beating on it and started singing what he knew of "That's All Right, Mama." Now, no one understands or knows why he even began to sing that song. It was just out of fear and nervousness. And Sam poked his head out as he's singing, "Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you." Well, of course, Sam knew the song. He had recorded it earlier with Arthur Crudup. And he said, "What are you doing out there?" And he said, "Also, I'm sorry, Mr. Phillips. I didn't mean to." "No, no." He said, "I want you to do that again. Get these boys back in there to playing." And that's the magic. It was a pure accident. They did two takes of it. And that's how Arthur Crudup's blues song became the rockabilly icon, "That's All Right, Mama." Now, rush forward, if you will, they had to have a B-side. They put it on the... Sam Phillips was so anxious, so excited, because he had found, and truly, his dream. And he had a friend that was on one of the radio stations there in Memphis. Literally, the next day, he cut an acetate and took it over, and they played it. And the people in the streets that night, literally, both black and white, were dancing in the streets. They got 4,500 requests for it from local radio, from local record shops, before they even had anything near a record finished. So a week later, now they're trying to find a B-side. A week later, almost the same thing happened. They're back in the studio. They're trying to find the magic, get the genie out of the bottle again. And what happened was Bill Black all of a sudden started just making fun. He was sort of a comedian anyway. He started playing the bass and played the what was considered as a classic, almost sacred song with Blue Moon of Kentucky from, you know, the bluegrass icon of Bill Monroe. And this was done as a waltz originally by Bill Monroe, you know, Blue Moon of Kentucky, and very simple. And, of course, what Bill Mack was doing is Blue Moon of Kentucky, just keep on shining, and slapping the bass. And, again, Elvis started singing along with him, laughing, playing, and started making fun of the song. And Sam Phillips said, that's it. That's the magic. Let's do it. And they recorded it. And there you've got two magic sides, one coming from the bluegrass version they did in a rockabilly or rock and roll style, and the other, of course, being the Delta blues brought to the center of rock and roll and rockabilly.
Well, let's
magic
talk.
And action.
Oh yeah. Well, let's talk about those other people you mentioned who felt this energy from those early songs and from Elvis's live show and those famous January 1955 concerts. Let's talk about Buddy Holly. And how he gravitated toward this music. And when you think about it, his career was really short, only about 18 months.
Only 18 months.
And, but it was so jam-packed.
Well, and amazing, such an influence. He influenced, acts like, of course, the Beatles named themselves after us, after the Crickets, because of their love for Buddy Holly. They formed their group to actually be the same as the Crickets were. And as Paul McCartney says in our documentary, and we quote him in the book, he says that he and John Lennon were the first songs that they wrote, the great hit songs they wrote, were very, very Buddy-ish. I mean, they were very, very much in love with Buddy Holly's writing, his performing, his guitar playing, and the fact that he wore glasses on stage. There are several things that they loved, but they loved the sound of the music. And they were heavily influenced. Then the extreme list of great artists like Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, Christofferson, who is a part of our project, Chris Christofferson, said that he, in the 60s, heard again while he was at Oxford, he listened to Buddy Holly songs on the BBC, and he said it was that caused him to become make the final decision to become a professional songwriter. And he says songs like Me and Bobby McGee, he said, that's a Buddy Holly song. I didn't think about that until I'm getting ready to record it. It's the 50th anniversary of Buddy's death. But if you think about it, Me and Bobby McGee is indeed written in a perfect Buddy Holly structure for the little hiccups and everything, you know, la-da-da-da-da-da, and all the hiccup places are in there. But it influenced music from that point on. Earlier influences, of course, you can't take away from Carl Perkins. We go back a little bit. Carl Perkins, who heard Elvis on the radio with that first Blue Moon of Kentucky and That's All Right Mama, rushed down to Sun's studio to 706 Union Avenue and said, I can do that. Well, he had to beg his way in and actually block the door to keep Sam Phillips. He got there before Sam Phillips came back from an appointment. And as Sam says, the man was on his knees crying. Here's this tall hillbilly on his knees crying, begging me to record him. And the result of that, of course, the song you played at the beginning of the show, Blue Suede Shoes.
Yeah, the big famous song that was also become famous from Elvis. And I found it interesting to learn that the original handwritten lyrics are now in the Smithsonian.
Well, on a potato sack, a brown paper potato sack, a sack that had two potatoes in it, 2 o'clock in the morning, he comes home. It was Johnny Cash that inspired him. My dear friend Johnny Cash inspired him, Carl, to write that song. And he said they were pals. Johnny Cash was the next to come in order. It was Elvis Presley first, and then Carl Perkins, and then Johnny Cash. And when Cash came in to Sun Studio, as an aside, he wanted to do gospel songs. Again, it's that lineage, it's history of. He wanted to just do gospel songs, and he had written several. And Sam Phillips said to him, Johnny said, I like the way you sing, but go out and sin a little bit like Elvis and come back. Let's record some of those songs that you write from that. And, of course, he had already written while he was in the Air Force, which takes us back to Carl Perkins. He had already written I Walk the Line and Folsom Prison Blues. So, and another song called Cry, Cry, Cry. So he came in and sang those for Sam, and as we say, the rest is truly history. But he got with Carl Perkins as they were doing little high school tours in around Memphis, and he said one night, "Why don't you write a song about shoes?" He said, "How in the world," Carl said, "can you do a song about shoes?" And he said, "Well, I had this friend while I was in the Air Force in Germany, and every time we'd go out, had to wear our full, you know, military uniform. But this guy was a wonderful guy from the South, and he'd say, 'Well, what are you wearing tonight?' And he says, 'I'm wearing my blue suede shoes.'" And it was just a thing they had. So he said, "Write a song about blue suede shoes." Well, the one night, Carl and his band was working at a high school prom, and this young man was wearing blue suede shoes, and he came up right in front of the dancing with his girlfriend right in front of the microphone, and she stepped on his shoes. He said, "Uh-uh, don't step on my suedes." Well, it upset Carl so much that he treated her so roughly, and he went home that night. All he had to write on was this paper bag he dumped out at 2 o'clock in the morning, as he tells the story, and he took two potatoes out of the sack, didn't even know how, according to Carl, didn't know how to spell suede. He spelled it SWADE, and he wrote from the little nursery rhyme that we all grew up with, "It's one for the bunny, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go," and he went off and wrote, within minutes, Blue Suede Shoes. And as they say, the rest indeed is history. His recording of that, by the way, Jason, was the first million-selling record at Sun Records, and actually indeed outsold Elvis. Elvis promised not to cover that song. And Elvis left Sun Records in 1956 and went over to RCA. And he didn't really cover it as a single. It was an EP. That's where the extended play record, where they had 45 RPM, but it was two songs on either side. So he didn't make a single out of it. It was part of a so-called extended play album. But it was huge. He did it on television first. Actually, Carl Perkins, I know we're running out of time, but Carl Perkins was on his way, when his record was number one, was on the way to New York to do the Perry Como show, and they had a very serious automobile accident, a head-on crash with a pickup. Sadly, he was injured. He broke his collarbone and a couple of other places, and his brother, who played bass, was very badly injured, and it killed the other man that was in the other car. And while he was in hospital, right there in about 120 miles from New York City, he was laying there and saw it on television. Elvis came on and said, "I want to do my new song." And he said, "It's one for the money." And he looked up and he said, "Well, there it goes."
Well, this is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking about rockabilly today with Jerry Naylor and Steve Halliday, talking about the legends of rockabilly, just talking about Carl Perkins there. And you mentioned a little bit earlier Johnny Cash, and let's get Steve back into the conversation here. I found it so ironic and prophetic that Sam Phillips told Johnny Cash to go sin a little, because, you know, Johnny Cash fought those demons all his life about sinning and trying to keep on the straight and narrow, walk the line, as he would say. You know, he was very much that classic rockabilly sound, but he also transcended a lot of that. You know, what did he get out of those early years with Sun Records, and, you know, how did that shape the rest of his career?
Well, Jerry is really going to be able to give you a lot of detail there, but as I was helping him write the book, I learned an awful lot. And the interesting thing to me was, from the very beginning, Sam Phillips, who could be a pretty rough character, Johnny Cash came in. He was always this very gentlemanly young guy. He, like Jerry said, at first all he wanted to do was to record the gospel recordings, and Sam tells him to go out and sin a little bit, and he probably did quite a bit more than he wished he ever would, because he said, as you said, those demons followed him throughout his whole life. But he never really left those roots. That was always at the core of what he felt he was all about. He might have had difficulty dealing with all of that stuff, but he really still always had that core of the gospel interest or focus or whatever you want to call it at the center of his person, even when he was dealing with all of that stuff. There's a lot of interesting stories about when Johnny first showed up, Sam didn't want to record him either. And when Johnny Cash had gotten some success, he had suggested that Roy Orbison call Sam and ask him about recording, and Phillips told him, I don't need any more singers, and Johnny Cash doesn't run my recording business. I mean, it's full of stuff like that. One of the things that Jerry talks about a lot about, he already has today, was how much the history of rock and roll and rockabilly depends on accidents. I mean, all of these guys wanted to play just what they felt in their hearts. They weren't thinking about, okay, I want to become the next star. None of them were really thinking that. They wanted to play their music. And accident after accident after accident. In fact, one of my favorite quotes, I just found out this morning, it didn't make it into the book. Our designer cut it out because we didn't have enough room, apparently. But it's one of my favorite quotes from the son of Buddy Knox, who is one of the guys that we profile at the end of the book. He says, if you listen to these recordings, meaning his dad's and the other rockabilly guys, he says, there are no mistakes. You know it's almost literally perfect, but here's the line I love. And he says, if there is some imperfection, even the imperfection is perfect. That is just remarkable to me, because what that tells me is that one of the things that made this music go was the rawness of it, the just coming from the soul. And even if there are mistakes, even those mistakes are perfect, in that if you could go into a studio and wipe off all the mistakes and make it perfectly technically correct, you wouldn't have had the same effect that these guys had with the rockabilly that they created. That, to me, is fascinating.
I think Jason, Charlie Daniels, and we go back to Johnny Cash. Charlie Daniels, who's again in our project in the feature documentary and quoted in the book, he said about Johnny Cash. He said, had there not been a Luther Perkins, who was Johnny Cash's guitar player, these were not very good. And Marshall Grant played bass. These guys were not really good professional musicians, and they flipped a coin to see who would play guitar and who would play bass. And yet they had such a unique, perfect example, of course, is the iconic trademark of Luther Perkins' guitar underscoring everything that Johnny Cash did, with that doom chicka doom chicka doom. And if you go anywhere in the world and you just hum this intro that Luther Perkins created, dom 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 chicka dom, and anywhere they'll say Johnny Cash, because it's a trademark. And it's also a bit of a complex simplicity, because when other great guitarists or other guitarists try to copy that, it is almost impossible to copy because of its unique simplicity and yet its uniqueness of complexity. And I know that's perhaps an oxymoron, but it's something for study, because it's what it was. You go back to Buddy Holly again, as we were talking, Jason. He identified with guitar licks as well, the Peggy Sue. Matter of fact, if you wanted to play guitar like Buddy Holly, you had to play the Fender guitar wrong, all not up and down licks. You had to play all downstrokes, because that's how he played. So there are all kinds of these that carry through all of these, again, accidents that brought forth this amazing change of music from the 50s and influenced all music that's certainly popular in rock music and country music that's followed.
From Johnny Cash, I want to move over to Roy Orbison. We touched on him briefly, but he was another guy who had a hard time getting started. The song Oobie Doobie had to be recorded three times before they really found the magic in that one. And I actually want to play a little bit of that, if you guys don't mind.
Sure.
Do we have that set to go? Okay, here's Roy Orbison and Oobie Doobie.
Hey, baby, jump over here when you do the Oobie Doobie. I just got to be near Oobie Doobie.
Okay, just a bit there of Roy Orbison's Oobie Doobie. And was that the third take of that one?
That is the third take, actually. That's the one that was done at Sun Studio. Steve mentioned a bit ago when of course, these Louisiana Hayride shows. As I mentioned, Roy was on it, met Johnny Cash in one of those. Johnny Cash went down to the Louisiana Hayride as well, and we all worked together there. And he indeed called and said, Sam Phillips, can let's see if he can put you on Sun Records. And of course, you heard what happened. Sam hung up on him. Said, I don't need any more artists. I got Elvis and Johnny Cash doesn't run my company. Well, about a month later, we all were determined. So Roy went into the Norman Petty studio, which was not even a commercial recording studio at Clovis at that time. And of course, Norman Petty, all of a sudden, your ears will perk up, because that's where not only Buddy Knox recorded the famous $60 session where he got 2 million selling records. Party Doll sold over 15 million records. And then, of course, right after that, Buddy Holly came in 1956 and recorded That'll Be the Day with the Crickets, and then all those great hits, Peggy Sue and everything after that, in that 18-month period from 1957 forward. And so Roy Orbison took his demo record of Ooby Dooby, and it somehow got to Sam Phillips, a friend, and actually owned a record store in Midland, sent it down to Sam Phillips. But when Sam heard it, he said, "How quickly can you get that guy down here?" Not remembering the telephone call, which was just a couple of months before. So he calls him, says, "Get down here right now." Roy gets the Teen Kings, gets in his car, drives to Memphis. They record Ooby Dooby, and it went on the charts, and it sold about 300,000 records, which was a huge hit in those days. And it really launched his career. And he recorded several others excellent rockabilly songs in that time, The Cat Called Domino, for instance, and Rock House. These are wonderful classics. And yet he wasn't satisfied with Roy wasn't satisfied. He could hear other things in his head. And it was from moving from Sun Studio over to Fred Foster's studio at Monument, where all this great magic happened. And he had hit after hit after hit. Imagine, we call it the Ooby Dooby to Pretty Woman opera.
I know, it's absolutely amazing that the same guy who does that goofy little rockabilly tune goes on in the 1960s to write these just wonderful and heartbreaking pop songs.
Well, only the lonely and by you. I mean, you go through all this great list of songs.
One of my favorite quotes about Roy Orbison is Bill Griggs, who's a 50s rock and roll historian, rockabilly historian, says, "Elvis Presley was once asked, 'Who do you fear?' Elvis never answered that question, but he said, 'I think the greatest voice in the world is Roy Orbison.'"
Yeah,
that's a great quote. I love that quote, because you do you sense, even in the beginning, in these early songs, what was to become the Roy Orbison sound. Let's move on to probably one of the wildest guys on the rockabilly scene. That would be Jerry Lee Lewis, the Killer, as people call him, and they still do. Where did all that come from? All that energy, all that sort of just raw passion.
Well, hunger, I think. You know, he and his, he lived in Faraday, Louisiana, for one thing. I lived in Carlsbad, Texas. We all wanted to get out of where we were. And the way we were going to remove ourselves at that point, we thought, was only through music. And he and his cousins, Mickey Gilley and Jimmy Swaggart, their first cousins, they all wanted to play piano. And Jerry Lee's parents sold a bunch of eggs. You know, they lived on a little farm there in Faraday, Louisiana, and had some chickens, and they sold enough eggs to buy an old used piano. And the three of them would practice on it. They had no lessons. And they would go to the, you know, down in Louisiana, the black churches are houses, general houses that people live in, and other churches. But in this case, they wanted to, again, do like we all did and sneak up to the back, you know, these churches to hear this great gospel music, black gospel music. And these guys would go in and sneak under these churches, crawl up under on the dirt up underneath these churches, and get right underneath where the piano player was keeping time. And you could hear the music right there, and they would carve out in the Louisiana clay there underneath that soft clay dirt a piano keyboard, and they would shadow play, and that's how they learned to play the piano. They would take that back in their memory and go back to that old spinet piano, and from that came the greatness of that indeed Jerry Lee Lewis was born with. How he got to Sun Records is that, again, he heard Elvis's songs, and he said, Daddy, he was picking corn with his dad, and he said, Daddy, I'm going to Memphis. There's a guy down there that I know I'm going to get to be a star. So I'm good as Elvis Presley. He got down there and literally forced his way in, not forced his way in physically, but he told the receptionist that he could play the piano exactly like Chet Atkins played the guitar. Well, Chet Atkins at that time was one of the great guitar players of the world. So a friend of ours, Cowboy Jack Clement, was doing a session with Roy Orbison, as a matter of fact, a demo session with Roy. And so the secretary comes back and tells him that this guy out here swears he can play piano just like Chet Atkins. He said, well, I got to hear that. Brought him in the middle of the session. The guys took a rest, and he sat down at this old spinet piano again there in the studio and just started wailing on a whole lot of shaking going on. And they literally, he said, hold on, let me turn this machine on. The musicians didn't know it. They just started playing. And that's one of those magic, unplanned sessions. And from that came greatness. It was just amazing.
Well, I mean, to see the footage, as you have in your DVD, of Jerry Lee Lewis performing, I mean, there's just this phonetic energy. I mean, he jumps on the piano, you know, just grabs the microphone stand and is just stomping. And, you know, of course, he was infamous and known for setting pianos on fire and the like. I mean, he was just the embodiment of all this energy unleashed.
Well, imagine, you know, the contrast of all that. I don't know if you remember it, but every time we have Jerry Lee Lewis or somebody talking about Jerry Lee Lewis in our documentary, I underscore it with Mozart, with Amadeus Mozart. And a lot of people, after they think about it, after they see it a couple of times, they say, what does this have to do with Jerry Lee? Well, it's a contrast of two of, I think, the greatest artists I've ever known in my life. I didn't know Amadeus Mozart, but known of, and I certainly know Jerry Lee. I'd worked with him a lot. But I believe these, first of all, were two of the most talented individuals I'd ever met in Jerry Lee Lewis I'd ever heard. And yet they were the most irreverent, two of the most irreverent people I could ever think of. And Jerry Lee Lewis epitomizes that. He wanted to be a preacher. You know, he went to Bible school, and they threw him out about a month into the school. And that really gave him a complex for the rest of his life, till this day. And yet, it's volatility, I guess, is the best word you could put on it. And what he has done to, what is that quote we have, Steve, where someone talks about, does your band have a piano player?
It's one of the ones I was just thinking about. If this is the one you're thinking of, they ask, you know, the manager of one of the venues if they have a piano for whoever's coming, said, well, we did, but Jerry Lee Lewis burned it up. You know, when I read that for the first time, I didn't know these guys like Jerry did. And I thought, well, he's speaking metaphorically. And then, you know, you read more and you hear more and you talk to Jerry, and he did. He literally burned them up.
Sprayed it with lighter fluid. Sprayed it with lighter fluid, set it aflame, and was playing it till it fell down.
And didn't you say, Jerry, that he got thrown out of Bible school because they asked him to play, it was one of the classic hymns, and he did a little jazzing up of it, and they didn't appreciate it.
He played it with just a little, you know, a little boogie blues style, and they didn't appreciate it, and they threw him out. They threw him out immediately, which is sad, actually.
Well, you know, he's one of the last guys still around, and I actually saw him a couple of years ago at a rockabilly festival out in Green Bay in 2005, and he's still crazy. I mean, he can still just wow a crowd, even in now, you know, so many years later. It's fun to actually see him perform live. And like I said, you know, he's one of the last guys there.
Jason, I have to tell you that I never can, I don't think there's anyone else that I ever toured with that I enjoyed more. First of all, you never knew what was going to happen next. And even with the predictions of, you know, what you'd seen him done in the past, you see him do in the past, you had no idea what he was going to do this time. But sometime he would be as sedate as he could be and just sing wonderfully. I mean, he always performed. He always, whatever he did, he always performed with pure magic. People loved it. I mean, the more crazy it was, if he got on top of the piano or wherever, whatever happened, that was just, people accepted it. You know, we were in Alaska one time, of all places, and they had a white grand piano. And the manager of the place, owner of the place, said, what are we going to do with this piano? And I said, well, what you could do before he starts is get a great big black marker and have him sign his name on that piano. And he said, why? And I said, well, when he tears it up, you can auction it off piece by piece and make more money than probably you'll make off this concert.
Well, you know, there is so much more we could talk about with these artists and the history of rockabilly, but I'm afraid we've used up our time today. So I do want to thank the two of you, Jerry Naylor and Steve Halliday, for joining me today. They are the authors of The Rockabilly Legends. They called it rockabilly long before they called it rock roll. It's published by the Jerry Naylor Company and Hal Leonard. There's also a DVD that goes along with it. And Jerry and Steve, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you very, very much, Jason. It's a pleasure, and we look forward to doing it again. By the way, the book is available wherever books are sold, and certainly on Amazon.com, and even RockabillyLegends.com.
All right.
Well, and we welcome anyone to have a copy of it. It's a collector's piece.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.